From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, how many times have you been asked, what is the CTCSS frequency? Probably not many, I bet.
Not many.
That's
an interesting abbreviation. It's one of those abbreviations that unfortunately is not pronounceable, so it's not exactly an acronym.
But now if I asked you, what's the PL frequency?
100 hertz.
Well, see? And you'll have to explain to everybody now why I said PL. And
yeah, exactly. And I actually wasn't too sure about what we're allowed to say here, but the term PL is a registered trademark of Motorola. It stands for private line. There are other ones. General Electric has one called Channel Guard, and RCA, which was also in the two-way FM business, has a quiet channel offering, and Johnson has one, and somebody else has the other. But they're basically the same kind of system, but those are particular trademark names that they use. So we can't, in the magazine, we can't call them PL. We call them the generic name, which is Continuous Tone Coded Squelch System.
CTCSS.
Exactly. Basically, the idea is, first of all, in the two-way radio business, the reason it became developed was the FCC was running out of two-way radio channels in some areas. And so they ended up having to assign the same channel to multiple users. So you could have an oil company on a frequency, and a taxi company could be assigned the same channel. Well, it probably is best if they weren't in the same business and competitors, but if they were not related in that way, they pretty soon, it worked okay, but they got tired of listening to the traffic from the other company. What this did was each company had a particular audio frequency, subaudible audio frequency. The frequencies, a whole bunch, I forget how many, but in the 30s or 40s.
Quite a few, yeah.
Between 67 and 250 hertz. And all of those are below the usual radio audio frequency cutoff for voice.
Is that why they call them, by the way, sub-audible?
Yes. They're below the audio range. In addition to being sub-frequency, they're also sub-amplitude. They're not modulated as heavily as the voice signal is. Every now and then, if somebody has their gain up too high on the transmit side, you will hear a little bit of a buzz in the background, and could well be the PL tone or the CTCSS tone.
Now, just to clarify, of course, we're talking about analog FM transceivers.
Analog FM transceivers, exactly.
Which is where this technology is used.
Right, and that's where it came from in the industry before. So going back to that story, the fact that you didn't hear, you only heard, your radio only opened up to squelch when that tone was present. So if you had two different companies, they had two different tones, and the taxis got the ones that had their frequency tone, and the oil company heard the dispatcher announcements that had their tone. So that all worked well, except, of course, the channel was in use by the other company, even though you didn't know it. And if you started talking in the middle of that, you'd be interrupting their conversation. So the way it worked was when you picked up your microphone off the metal mic hanger, that automatically opened the squelch, defeated the CTCSS. So you had to monitor the channel, make sure nobody was talking. And by virtue of that feature, that happened automatically as soon as you picked up your microphone. So that was a point to keep in mind about how these things work. Now, in the amateur world, it's a slightly different situation. The amateur world picked up on this technology not because there were too many people wanting licenses, but because there were not enough repeater pairs to go around. So you had repeaters on the same frequency, perhaps in the next town. And of course, in that situation, it would not be the same difference in content that you'd have between two different companies. You'd have somebody saying, this is W1ZR, listening on whatever frequency. And of course, if you triggered two repeaters because you were in between them, people in both repeater communities would think you were talking to their repeater, which of course you kind of were. But perhaps you were in a situation where your local repeater, you could hear your local repeater, but you couldn't hear people from the other local repeater. So, depending on how many hills are in between and so forth, all kinds of combinations there. But the idea being you want to just talk through the repeater that you intend to, because that's where the people that you want to talk to will be listening and so forth. So early on, many of the FM radios, mobile radios, had provision for a single CTCSS tone. And what happened was the people in a particular community would all select the same tone for their different repeaters. And then you'd move to another community across the next mountain, and you'd get a whole new set of repeaters on the same, perhaps the same frequencies, but with a different tone. And that way they didn't interfere with each other. And that worked reasonably well, although now most radios can do any number of tones without a problem. So you no longer see that kind of a system set up. But it turns out that there are actually some issues going the other way. Initially, pretty much the only place you saw the tones used was from the mobile towards the repeater, so you just bring up the right repeater. After a while, it became clear that it would be good to have the opportunity to do it in the other direction. For example, in my car, I can only hear the repeaters in my local area, which works fine. But I also have a radio in the kitchen with an outside antenna that we use. Used to be Nancy and I would commute on different days, and we'd have the radio on in the kitchen, and somebody could say when they were getting close enough to home to put the water on for the tea or put the ice cubes in the glass or start the oven for dinner. So around commute time, we'd keep the radio on and listen for traffic. Well, what we were finding was we were in Connecticut, but Squelch would open from a repeater in New Jersey, which you'd never hear on the mobile, but because of the outside antenna, they would come through just fine. And I'd go running out into the kitchen to see what was happening, and it wasn't Nancy, it was somebody in New Jersey talking through a repeater there. So the repeaters started transmitting the tone. Sometimes they'd take the same tone and retransmit it, or sometimes they'd generate a perhaps different tone. Most modern two-meter FM radios that have tone squelch, which all of them do, now also have the provision to open only on receiving a certain tone. So you can set that up on a channel in the channel memory separately, because sometimes it's a different tone. So that's very handy as well. So it's kind of a different purpose, but the same idea. So that's what it's about, and it works reasonably well. Very infrequently do you have problems where you have false triggering. Sometimes you have problems where, in which the modulation is up and down and the signal is up and down, it'll drop out coming into the repeater because the tone is not strong enough to get through. And there's a new system that many FM transceivers support, which is called digital-coded squelch. And this is very similar in function, but it's made up of a digital code word that's transmitted using subaudible parts of the spectrum. And that has error correction built into it and redundancy so that it's less likely to either be false triggered or lost inappropriately during a transmission. So that's the most recent phenomenon.
There used to be a time when not all repeaters, I remember, had CTCSS. And one of my irksome things back then was people would use PL. Of course, they still do today, rather than saying CTCSS, which is a mouthful. They'll say PL, but they'll use it as a verb. They'll say, oh, somebody PL'd the repeater, meaning, of course, that they added CTCSS to the repeater. And they didn't know what the frequency was. Now, of course, many, as we're talking about modern rigs, many modern rigs have the ability to scan for the particular tone that's in use.
That's absolutely correct, and that's a good point that you can do that, but only if the repeater actually transmits it.
That's right.
Because generally the audio connection between the receive side of the repeater and the transmit side of the repeater is designed to pass the audio frequencies, and of course these are below those. Some people try to use PL tones as a privacy measure or to restrict access to club members or whatever.
Yes. Well, let's take a break.
Okay.
And hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. in addition to PL, if I may. I'm allowed to say that. I'm allowed to say private line.
Well,
sure.
You're the guy that knows about the trademark
well,
stuff.
Well, we already declared that it was a trademark of Motorola,
yep.
So there's no confusion. But in addition to PL, which is still used among FM analog transceivers all over the place, you've still got also another signaling system, but DTMF.
Yeah.
And what I call it, here we go again with the trademarks, I call it touch tone.
Uh-huh.
But see, I shouldn't do that, should I?
Probably not. That's probably an AT&T trademark, I would guess.
Yeah, but we all call it touch tone.
We do. Well, I don't know. I call it DTMF. But what's interesting is almost nobody calls it anything anymore.
Well, you're an engineer, so that's...
Yeah, I speak in four-letter groups. I don't use words. Yeah, and that's, you know, that takes me back because back in the early days of repeaters, that was one of the big things about repeaters was if you were on the road, stuck on the highway, you could dial up, use your touch tone keypad on your mic, usually, and you could bring up an auto patch in the repeater, and that would allow you to call, make usually a local call from the repeater location to somewhere. Now, if it's a local repeater that's near where you live, that probably meant you could call home. There were restrictions. You weren't allowed to order a pizza, I don't think, but you...
They changed that somewhat.
You can order a pizza, but you can't buy a pizza company.
Something like that,
something
yes.
Something like that, yes. So it has to be non-commercial. And that was very handy. Again, if you get stuck in traffic on the way home, if you didn't have a FM radio in the kitchen with a wife with a ham license, you could call her on the phone. And that worked very well. And that was before cell phones, particularly. So that would be back. And I guess there were various kinds of mobile telephone services offered into the 50s and 60s even, but it didn't become very popular until cell phones in the 90s, I guess.
Yes. And that was pretty much the end of auto patch once
yeah.
the cell phones
took
over.
It took some years. But the other thing that's interesting about it is DTMF was not just used for auto patch. It may still be used because it was used, the repeater had to be able to decode it. And you could send in addition to the, how many buttons are there on a phone? I guess 12 buttons on a phone. There's another four sets of dual tones.
Yes.
By the way, these tones are in band. You can actually hear them, so you can hear somebody doing this. There are another set of keys that you can add that are in some touch tone microphones and certainly in external pads. And those are used frequently to control the repeater function. So you could turn a repeater off. You could sometimes get a repeater that's stuck in transmit or something. You can,
mm-hmm.
if you can get a signal to it through a remote, you can turn it off. You can stop somebody from talking. You can do all kinds of things. There's some functions that it had. Sometimes you could set up a frequency meter function so you can tell if your frequency is on channel when you call in. Modulation level. You can cause all these functions to happen with a touch tone. But because it's very rare now, at least around here, to have auto patches, I see very few repeaters that are equipped to deal with touch tone signals, as
yeah,
far as I know. I guess they could be, and just the control operator may use them. They may use that same phone line that they use to get to the phone company from the auto patch to be able to dial in to control the repeater remotely going in the other direction. So you don't see that too often anymore, which is kind of a shame. I always thought that was kind of an unfortunate result of technology.
Now, dual tone being two tones, mm-hmm. obviously, two tones simultaneously.
Right.
What was special about that when it came to decoding and control?
Well, it was what was special was it was developed by the phone company, so it was readily available.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the idea was you had kind of a matrix on the phone. You had three across and four up and down, I guess. And each across set of three had a common tone. There was a low group and a high group. I forget which one with which. And the other ones had one from the other group. So where the two picture vertical and horizontal lines, where they intersected at a button, you would send out those two tones. And then the equipment at the other end had to be able to filter them out and detect them. There were some constraints in terms of the relationship between them. So you couldn't have harmonics be able to trigger a tone. So you know there was a group of low frequencies and a group of high frequencies, relatively, and they were set up so the harmonics of the low frequencies didn't fall on any of the high frequencies and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be...
It was a pretty clever system when you think about it.
It was a clever system. What was particularly clever for the phone companies, as someone who has worked for phone companies, it used to be that at least our phone company used to charge extra for touch tone. So what people did, first of all, You could buy a phone that had a touch-tone pad on it, but it would actually send out pulses.
Yes.
It took a lot longer to send the number. But the other thing that was interesting was it actually cost the phone company less to handle touch-tone than it did rotary dial. But they charged extra for the touch-tone anyway because it was a feature.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was kind of clever. But it works well, and you can do a lot with it. And you can pull out the signals and do whatever, you know, whatever logic, control logic you want to have happen.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, it's not, I can't even think now if most radios still have them on the mics.
Many do, although usually you have to purchase a deluxe mic, external mic. Handheld transceivers still have touch-tone pads for the most part. It depends, but you're right. It's less and less and less frequent as time goes on because there just isn't the application for it. We still sell in QST Magazine, I don't mean we sell it, we still advertise is what I meant to say, a touch-tone decoder board that I can't remember the name of the company right now, but they've been advertising this board in QST for many years. So there's still application for using touch-tones to control things wirelessly, but just not nearly as frequent as it used to be.
Used to be almost every repeater had a auto patch.
Yeah.
And I actually missed that a lot because I was probably one of the last people to ever buy a cell phone.
When you were talking about the frequencies of touch tones, I remember that a local repeater, I don't know if it just wasn't calibrated correctly or what, but there was some young man who used to get on and he had a rather high-pitched voice. I guess puberty hadn't fully kicked in yet. And while he was talking, he would false the touch tone decoder on, you know, the dial tone would come up, you know, something of that nature. It interpreted his voice as being touch tones.
Well, he probably could have had a really good business of doing something with that. I'm not sure what exactly.
Well, would you like to take a question, Joel?
Sure, why not?
Why not? Okay, we'll a short one here. We'll make it relatively brief. This one comes from N7QL. And he asks, if I had an inverted V cut for 3.8 megahertz, and I feed it with 1/2 wavelength of 50 ohm coax, should I have a 1-to-1 SWR or nearly so at the transmitter? If I change the coax to 1/2 wavelength of 450 ohm window line, what would be the SWR at the transmitter?
That's a good question. And of course, the first part of it has to do, let's assume that the antenna has an impedance of 50 ohms at that and is resonant at that frequency. Then you have a 50 ohm impedance at the antenna, you have a 50 ohm transmission line. What that means is the characteristic impedance of 50 ohms means that if you terminate it in 50 ohms, you'll see 50 ohms at the transmitter end. So yes, you'll have a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Of course, if it happened to be 25 ohms at the antenna, you'd have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. But whatever it is, the electrical half wavelength will repeat the impedance at the far end. So if it was 25 ohms at the far end and 2-to-1, it would be 2-to-1 at the near end as well. But not only would it be 2-to-1, but it would be also 25 ohms because there are a lot of impedances that could be 2-to-1. And if it were a different length, it would be a different impedance. But a half wavelength will repeat the impedance at the other end no matter what it is. So if that same antenna with a 50 ohm feed impedance is fed by an electrical half wavelength of 450 ohm line, it will still have a 50 ohm impedance at the bottom. Even though that's nothing to do with the characteristic impedance, that's a 9-to-1 SWR. Different lengths of line will have widely varying impedances because it's quite a high SWR. But at that particular point, half wave point, it will be 50 ohms again. And similarly, at a full wavelength, it'll be 50 ohms also. At a quarter wavelength, it would be 9 times 450, which is roughly, let's say, 4,000 ohms. So the impedance varies widely, and it has to be cut exactly right to get it to be 50 ohms. And that's really the trick here, is the one-to-one match happens with a high SWR like that only for a very narrow band of frequencies. So as you move a little bit off frequency, the impedance will vary dramatically. Whereas with the 50-ohm coax, if you move a little off frequency, you'll have a different impedance at the antenna. You'll have a slightly different SWR, but it won't be dramatically different. Similarly, if you go to a full wavelength, the bandwidth is decreased as well. It keeps getting smaller and smaller because you get more rapidly changing as you move in frequency or length. So let's take 80 meters. The 2-to-1 bandwidth, 2-to-1 SWR bandwidth of that antenna itself is about 150 kilohertz. If you feed it with a half wavelength of window line, while the SWR at resonance will be 1-to-1, the 2-to-1 SWR bandwidth is reduced to 90 kilohertz. If you go to a full wave, it will still be 1-to-1 at resonance, but the 2-to-1 SWR bandwidth will be reduced to 63 kilohertz, with the bandwidth reducing more with each additional half wave of transmission line. So this also makes the trimming of the line very critical, because you don't have to be very far off of the half wave to have a very mismatched condition. And of course, the other thing is, at the end of the window line, you have a balanced system, and you probably don't want to just hook your coax to that. You want a common mode choke there, too.
Okay, Joel. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to be here.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.